Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. You know, miss a couple of days of the national news cycle, and you're bound to miss a big story. And of course, this was such a big story, and it was such a tragic story. And I'll put the thumbnail up on the screen. And of course, we recognize mother of five, Rachel Marin, Maryland mother of five. And there was an arrest in her murder, which occurred over a year ago, approximately a year ago. And the complexities of these crime scenes and why it's so important to have pristine crime scenes and to process evidence correctly, because you never know what is going to identify a perpetrator. And in this day of scientific evidence, specifically DNA, it's so important to consider everything as a potential piece of DNA evidence. And the interesting thing about this case, of course, we all remember this little picture here on the screen of who now turns out to be the perpetrator in this case. So he's got one of those multiple names. I'll pull it up on the screen. Well, there's a picture of him, of this evil little piece of shit. Victor Antonio Martinez Hernandez. He was here illegally from El Salvador and didn't come to this country because he wanted to work hard and better his life. He came to this country because he was fleeing his country for a murder that he committed in El Salvador. And these are the dangerous people coming into our country right now. And that's one of the reasons law enforcement has to be so diligent, has to be so good at their job, because of the policies like this. So an arrest has been made in the murder of Rachel Marin, according to Maryland authorities. The Harford County Sheriff's Office announced Saturday that Victor Antonio Martinez Hernandez, a citizen of El Salvador, was apprehended in Tulsa, Oklahoma, for the crime late Friday night. The 37-year-old mother of five was last seen on August 5th when she left for a walk on the Ma and Pa Heritage Trail in Bel Air, Maryland, at 6 p.m. Her boyfriend reported her missing later that night when she never returned home, and her body was found near the trail less than 24 hours later. Her death was later determined to be a homicide. 11 days later, the sheriff's office said that a DNA sample found at the crime scene was a match to a man wanted for a home invasion and an assault of a 9-year-old girl in Los Angeles. Authorities released surveillance video of the unknown male, but they weren't able to identify him. You know, that was one of the amazing things also, is that they had this connection really early on in this case. However, it took a long time to get him identified. And, you know, this is a big country. People move about freely. And he fled to Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And amazing, and we'll tell the story later on how they caught this guy. You see, the picture in the middle was an earlier sketch they did. And we would have assumed that the sketch was going to be extremely accurate because the 9-year-old girl from Los Angeles and her mom got a good look at him. And even though this was the surveillance camera of him coming out of the house, they got a good look at his face and they supplied that. But still, it took a long time to arrest him. And we'll get into that a little bit more. So folks, hold on to your hats. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off-the-cuff zone. There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped in 10th and Grant. You might apply there.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger. Joining me tonight to co-host with me is retired NYPD sergeant, professor at Albertus Magnus College in Connecticut, attorney, and all-round good guy, Professor Michael Geary. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. Thank you for having me on, and welcome everyone in the chat. Welcome.
You know, Mike, this is one of those cases that you want the guy caught the next day. It's just so vicious, and based on the facts that he committed two heinous crimes, not just one worse than the other, of course. And we never really did find out the extent of the violence in Los Angeles because the victim was 9 years old. But I would assume it was an SA crime. And the DNA that they recovered from that incident was from a baseball cap that he left at the scene. And the frustrating thing about it was, yes, they had his DNA, and they compared his DNA to Rachel Marin's, the DNA at the crime scene of Rachel Marin, and it was a match. But we still did not have a name to this individual or location or where did he live, because he's not in CODIS. And I'm sure early on in this case, they surmised that there's a good potential that he's not an American citizen, that he is here illegally. And with that said, he wouldn't be in the CODIS, the Combined DNA Identification System database, which has two types of DNA, perpetrated DNA and a forensic DNA that is from crime scenes. So both of these recoveries of DNA, both would be considered forensic, because it was DNA from two crime scenes that wasn't identified. Mike, weigh in with your wisdom.
Anytime you have a child involved in a crime, especially one with his SA involved, that will get every cop, anywhere connected with this case, working overtime, because everybody wants this person caught. If you are, attacking a child, you are doubly dangerous to the public, because you have no qualms about hurting the most defenseless kind of person there is. So everybody wants this guy caught as fast as possible. And I remember we discussed this many, many months ago, and we were looking at that video of him leaving the house in, after the attack on the girl. And we were just very frustrated because you couldn't get a really good look. And so many crimes today, and even one, they just had one in Queens that was wrapped up, I think, yesterday or today, where they got a good picture of the person through a basic surveillance camera, and you didn't have that picture. So it made it really frustrating. And then when you get the match, you're like, okay, broke through. Okay. We know who we're dealing with. Now we got this person for two. And then you realize he's just still a mystery man. We have all this great technology and we can't use it right now. We can use it, but it's going to take a long time to figure out who this guy is. But, luckily, it's taken a year, almost a year, 11 months, but finally justice is served for these people who suffered greatly from this guy. It's about time.
You know, Mike, one of the things that to me is very, very scary is that you would want to count on your government, your Homeland Security, your Border Patrol guys to vet people coming into this country. And here's a guy that committed a murder in his country and we didn't even know about it. And he just is allowed to walk across the border and we have an instant criminal in our country. You know, there was one statement, and I've heard this statement a couple of times by some reporters, where they said, migrants, as they call them, that's the politically correct term, the term that really is illegal alien because they don't belong in this country. But what I was going to say is you'll hear news reporters say they don't commit a crime at any higher rate than American citizens. And I find that to be the most ignorant statement any news reporter could ever say, because first of all, yes, they do. They commit crime at 100% more because they don't belong here. All right. They're not supposed to be here. So let's start with that. So whatever crime they commit, crime is up 100% as per someone who's not supposed to be here. Yes, American citizens that commit crime, that's not a good thing either. But they're here legally. these people are here illegally and we can't even track them. And just when I heard that, my blood boiled, that statement by a news reporter who remained nameless.
Yeah, coming here illegally and they don't have, they're not vetted. They don't have social security numbers. They don't have addresses. They're like, it's almost like an underground railroad through the country where they go from point A to point B. They got on a plane, they get a ticket to come to court in like 7 years. And you get some NGOs, non-governmental organizations that say they're going to take care of them. And once, but you can't, once you're in here in this country, you can travel anywhere you want to. It's not like we have checkpoints, you know, in some sort of futuristic apocalyptic world. No, we don't have that sort of thing. So this person, we have so many people. I think right now we have 8 million, 9 million at least. They are in the underground of our society, moving from point A to point B. And we had no idea who they were coming over. We still don't know who they are. And it doesn't matter if this person is an illegal alien or a legal alien or an American citizen. These two crimes were horrific, and this person was caught. It just makes it that much more upsetting to people when you find out that this particular crime, this little girl who was assaulted in March, and then you've got Rachel Marin, who was assaulted last August. Without him, that's a homicide, an essay of a girl that never would have occurred. So don't, when people tell me, oh, you know, they don't commit crimes any more than the average citizen, they're here illegally, A, number one. And when they do commit crimes, those are crimes that were 100% preventable because they never would have occurred had that person not been allowed into the country.
You know, Mike, I also want to make it clear that I am 100% for legal immigration.
Right.
But we need to do it legally. And when you just allow your border to be open and people pour through, you're not protecting your citizenry. And the other girl, Lakin Riley, on a jog on the University of Georgia campus, murdered by an illegal. Another one. There's two. And a very short. And there's more. There's more because all across the country. So I just think it's a horrific thing when our government is not protecting its citizens, because the police can't do it all. And the police have a really, really difficult job, especially with these policies. I'm going to play a cut from News Nation. This is the chief of police.
Investigation is Harford County Sheriff Jeffrey Gaylor. And while the news of the arrest certainly counts as a win for law enforcement, Sheriff Gaylor, I'm sure you're in no mood to celebrate. You join us live now. You've had his DNA for months. You had an image caught on a security camera in Los Angeles. How did you finally link the DNA to Martinez Hernandez?
I just cannot. That tone from the reporter, like as if there's some incompetence that you've had his DNA. How did you finally? It's like, hold it, Trixie, whatever your name is, right? Do you even know how an investigation works? I mean, just the tone. News reporters think that police work is just, you know, throw a pizza in the oven and it'll be done in 10 minutes. You know, it's not the way it works.
Billy, you know, we saw this in the Kohberger case, 6 weeks, and people are like, it's a cold case. What are you talking about? It's a cold case. It's scary.
It is scary. Let's go back.
Hernandez.
Well, that was all done. And then at our press conference, our partner, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, special agent in charge of the Baltimore office, explained all the DNA stuff. And I've been in this field 40 years. A lot of it's passed me by. He explained how that narrowed down the pool and allowed us to come up with eventually all the way down to one person and put a name with the person out of the video, with the composite that we had. We've been able to match that DNA against evidence in the case, and that's what secured us the arrest warrant. Once we had the suspect name, we were able to secure the arrest warrant, and again met with Rachel's family. And within 5 hours of having the arrest warrant, using technology, we were able to track him through the internet devices and stuff that we believed he was in possession of, right out of billions of people on this planet, right to a bar stool in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
The FBI said that there was an investigative genetic genealogy team that helped crack this case. Is that what you're going to El Salvador? Is that what you think as well? Is that what you heard?
Yes. And he explained it. And it's outside of my realm of expertise by a long way. I can tell you, without their assistance, without the assistance of our friends at the state police and their crime lab, the DNA evidence in this case and science and electronic allowed us to go amongst all the suspects and all the people in the world and pull out this one suspect and positively link him as the murderer of Rachel Morin.
It's incredible, actually. When did you learn that he had fled El Salvador after allegedly murdering a young woman there?
Well, once we had his name, investigators who have worked this case so diligently over the past 10 months, once we had his name, the investigators were able to start doing a lot more detailed research on where he was, where he had been. And that's where we learned of the red notice and the accusations that he killed a woman in similar style, similar MO to what happened in Rachel's case before fleeing and crossing our border. And again, he attacked the 9-year-old in Los Angeles, and I'm very thankful that the police officers in that situation who responded there collected the evidence to give us that initial DNA hit from the DNA we recovered here. He traveled from L.A. He fled L.A. and he ends up in Harford County, Maryland, where he is encounters Rachel. How that took right. place is, you know, up. We're not 100% sure. Hopefully, maybe he'll talk. We'll see over a given time. But he, as you reported, he has waived extradition, so he'll be back here to answer for these charges rather than later.
I'm curious, you know, he allegedly murdered a woman in January in El Salvador, came to the United States in February. In March, he attacks this 9-year-old and her mother in Los Angeles. In August, he allegedly murders Rachel. And then we have 10 months where he doesn't do anything that you've been able to at least link to him. Do you really think he went off the grid and did nothing illegal for all those months? Or do you think there could be other victims out there?
Oh, certainly. I think there could be other victims. That's been a concern that I've spoke about since Rachel's homicide and in updates that we've provided to the community. That has been my fear, the fear of our men and women here, the investigators, that, he, even without knowing about the El Salvador case, that somebody capable of such a brutal act would do it again. And knock on wood, you know, so far we have no link, no information to indicate that he has. And I fear that case is yet to be discovered, but only time will tell.
And Sheriff, just finally, I got to ask you the frustration as a law enforcement chief yourself that somebody like this was able to cross our southern border illegally and get into this country and commit at least 3 crimes that we know of, if you count, you know, the 9-year-old and her mother is 2 and Rachel is the 3rd.
Absolutely. We live in a small county north of Baltimore, 260,000 people. This is in 2022. There was a murder by an MS-13 member, also from El Salvador, also in this country illegally, who murdered one of the Harford County, a woman here in Harford County. This is the second one in 2 years, happened to be both from El Salvador, both with gang ties who have taken a life. We need to address, and those stories are happening all across this country. We're not unique. You know, these stories are happening, whether you hear about them from your police chief or sheriff or mayor or governor. These cases are happening every single day. And we have a duty, and Congress has a duty, and as does the president, to protect our citizens and do a better job, come up with some immigration policy that works.
Thanks so much for watching.
So this chief is obviously old school. I sort of like him, you know. And, you know, 40 years on the job, I mean, yeah, technology can pass you by. Because guess what? Investigative genetic genealogy, a very small percentage of law enforcement officers really even understand that. And basically, it's a high technology thing where they use, not necessarily mitochondrial DNA, but they build family trees. They can also use nuclear DNA. And so the DNA that they have could tell them where he's from, actually. That's how advanced it is. Oh, yes, this guy's from South America, Salvador. It could tell actually the area you're from, which is unbelievable. Then they go to that area and they start canvassing. And you heard him say they also connected some dots using social media and using his electronic devices. So all of these advances in law enforcement are incredible. And but guess what, Mike? And you know, and I know, they take time. I didn't like the way this reporter was acting, like, oh, it took you so long. You know, like, give me a break, you know?
Billy, it's the demands of the news cycle. They want the information yesterday. We saw in the Brian Koberger case out in Idaho, within 6 weeks, they made the arrest. Right? You know, and people were saying, oh, my goodness, I think this is a cold case. We got to call in the FBI. What's going on? We're not getting any updates from Chief Fry. And so they're very frustrated and they don't know what to do. Well, guess what? Could you imagine how frustrating it is for things to go on like this when you're a detective and you want this case solved yesterday also? However, we understand that the science is going to take a while. That's how they identified Brian Koberger through his father's genetic genealogy, DNA, because he submitted his DNA to one of those labs, like 23andMe. And so we were able to build a family tree. Here you've got the same type of thing, but that takes a while. Patience, you know, is the watchword. This isn't like, you know, investigating homicides in the 1970s or some TV show, you know, Columbo on TV, no, or some Agatha Christie novel. No, this is much more complicated. And thank goodness we have the ability to do this. If we didn't have the advancements, especially recently in genetic genealogy, DNA, we might have maybe a half of a fingerprint somewhere, or maybe a little bit of DNA, or maybe not enough DNA. Because years ago, when DNA first became an accepted science, you needed like a lot of blood. It had to be blood. It couldn't be anything else. So thank goodness we are where we are today with this technology. And even though it takes a while, it's exact. And so that's the beauty of it. And, you know, it's pretty much, if you do it correctly, it's a no miss kind of thing, because you're going to get the person. And so we can be thankful for that. Everything takes time, but when you get the answer, you got the right answer.
Absolutely. Carol Grayston, one of our moderators, thank you so much. She gifted 5 Police Off the Cuff memberships to 5 lucky people that have now will be joining the Police Off the Cuff family. Carol, thank you so much. Sharon Reynolds, he's not in CODIS. Let me explain something, guys, about CODIS. CODIS is run by the FBI. It stands for the Combined DNA Index System, all right? To be in that database, you have to be convicted of a felony, or there's 2 types of DNA in that. 1, offender DNA. That is the person's convicted of a felony. There are certain felonies. Their DNA goes into CODIS. 2nd type is forensic DNA. And forensic DNA is DNA from crime scenes. So could his DNA be in CODIS just based on the fact that it was unidentified DNA from 2 crime scenes? Mike, do you know the answer to that?
It should be. You should have DNA sample, right?
Well, if it's forensic.
Right, exactly.
And it's from 2 crime scenes, but because that's not one, he doesn't have to be convicted of felony. We don't know who he is.
Right, exactly.
But it's from 2 horrific crime scenes, so it could be in CODIS. And then the FBI takes that DNA and they build a family tree based on investigative genetic genealogy. They figure out he's from El Salvador. They do a lot of workups. They have other leads, electronic devices, social media. They put it together. He's from El Salvador. They figure out who he is, that he did a murder there, and that's one of the reasons he fled there. And now they put a name, and they find out that he's in Tulsa, Oklahoma, sitting at a bar, and they go grab him sitting at. That's remarkable, but many people take it so for granted. Oh, police will figure it out. That's incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
Billy, it is incredible, and it's beyond many of our understanding of it, you know, because it is so scientific, and it's the people who, with the knowledge that they can explain this, they are very, very far above you and me. But the beauty of this all is that even though it takes time, it's very thorough, and you're not going to have this guy running around maybe until we get, like, say, like the old school blood, the blood, so that we could use DNA or a good fingerprint or things like that. And that in those days, you could have more serial killers, more serial SAers out there. Now, even though it takes time, you can cut them off at the pass as fast as possible and stop a lot of crimes. Stopping this person now, getting him now, probably will have saved, a dozen people from being victimized, at least in the next couple of years. So his career here, blessedly, was cut short. Not short enough, but luckily it was cut short through DNA. Fantastic job.
Well, Mike, I think also the answer that he was on the loose for 9 months and he was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Did he commit other crimes? I say undoubtedly. I would say they just don't know who the victims are yet. And perhaps that is the partnership with the police in the community that identifies perpetrators. They just had a horrific crime like this in New York City in Casino Park in Queens, where a 13-year-old, a male and a female, were attacked by another illegal with a machete. And they caught him within days. That's how good they were able to ID. And you know how they caught him? With the help of the community. They were able to put his photo out there. And as in Richard Ramirez style, the community grabbed him and started beating the shit out of him on the street. And good. The police got there. And yeah, good for the guy, right? But the cooperation between the community and the police grabbed that specific guy. And yeah, I just think it's a little bit scary that, you know, there is absolutely no vetting of people pouring through our border. And when these horrific things happen, their answer is, well, they don't commit crime at any higher rate as American citizens. I think that's the dumbest answer I have ever heard someone say trying to defend that position.
It doesn't make me feel any safer. Not at all. Just ride the subways in New York, take a bus in New York, go to Grand Central Station, go to, under an overpass, go to a park, and you see what New York City was back in the early 2000s, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, how beautiful it had turned into. It took a long time, and we've degenerated back into what I always say, welcome to the 1970s. It's terrible. And on top of that, you have all the illegals. We don't have the capability to take care of these people. And we have our rules. We're ignoring our own rules, and our own rules are there to protect our nation. Why are we, not complying with our own rules that we made up?
Absolutely.
Haven't heard a good answer on that one.
Rogerio Brito, I was really thinking that this would be like finding a needle in a haystack, almost impossible. Fortunately, I was wrong. Well, Rogerio, you hit it on the head. It is like finding a needle in a haystack, but DNA makes the haystack smaller and makes you able to find that needle, which is unbelievable, incredible. Let's play a little more of this other News Nation reporter here. They're all on top of this.
After 10 months, an arrest finally made. Now, we want to show you the suspect.
See, even she said it too. Finally made. It's like, it's just, arrest finally made.
Finally.
As if law enforcement is incompetent.
So this is 23-year-old Victor Martinez Hernandez. Police say he illegally crossed the border in February of 2023, fleeing from a crime they say he committed in El Salvador. They say he killed a woman there. And Morin was reported missing last August by her boyfriend, who said that she never returned home after she went out for a run on the Ma and Pa Trail just outside of Baltimore. Rachel's body was found on that trail the very next day. And authorities say it was DNA that broke the case wide open.
The lead we received was related to DNA evidence and allowed investigators to finally put a name to the image of the suspect in the video from Los Angeles, which we released 2 weeks after Rachel's death. After we had the video, we knew what he looked like. We knew what he looked like, but we didn't know who he was. With the new DNA evidence, now we know who he is, but we still didn't know where he was.
Now, once they had the DNA, Once they had the DNA sample, remember, they had the sample in Maryland. They had the sample in California. These two samples matched. They put it in the CODIS system. And so here's what they did. In order to do the genealogical DNA trackdown, they actually traveled all the way to El Salvador, to this guy's native country, to find people he was potentially related to. And we don't know the exact way that they found this guy. They wouldn't say, and that's fine. You know what? Because you know what matters is they found him, right? They say they found the guy that murdered Rachel and did the home invasion, assaulting that 9-year-old and her mom in California. Now, prosecutions are up next for this guy. Let's bring in our guests and talk more.
You know, it is unbelievable. And when someone said, Rogerio Brito said, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. And it's so true. And DNA allows law enforcement to find that needle in a haystack. Schmitty, Sergeant Bill, do you know if they had tracked him to the bar or if something happened in the bar which prompted a call to law enforcement? No, Schmitty, they actually tracked him to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they tracked him to that bar. I think there was some electronic devices involved in addition to social media. Apparently, they had this guy, and they had a name to him. So now they had to find him, and they knew he was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And how they got to this bar, I'm not exactly sure. They're not saying, but tremendous work. Absolutely tremendous work. Mike.
Yeah, Billy, I'm thinking right now, because they're being very tight-lipped, but it's possible that maybe they could figure out what his phone was, you know, and they might have been tracking his phone. And that's what I think may have been, but not sure. They're keeping it tight-lipped. I guess they're keeping it tight-lipped, which is good, because they want to frustrate anybody else who may be thinking of committing criminal acts like this, and they don't want to give away law enforcement secrets. But I'm thinking they may have known what phone, and they may have been getting cell phone tower information. If you can get it that quickly, you know, in real time, I'm not sure.
Liz Gee, no, he was not arrested for something else. They had him tracked. They were tracking him, and they had, based on investigative genetic genealogy, they were able to put a name to the DNA, and then they tracked him to Tulsa. He wasn't arrested for something else. He was wanted for a murder in El Salvador also. You know, one of the things, Mike, you know, and I come from an investigative background on the NYPD, and one of the things I think that protects citizenry is the tracking of offenders that commit crimes, say do their time, or commit crimes, do no time, but because of non-prosecution and decarceral policies. Decarceral is a fancy word for saying, we don't want to put you in jail. We don't want to put you in prison. We'd rather keep you out on the street where you keep attacking good people. But that seems to be the policy these days. So one of the things from an investigative standpoint is, how do we track criminals? Because of the 5% or the 3% of society that commit 80 to 90% of all the crime. Well, that is the role of law enforcement. And we start with photographs. We start with fingerprints. We start with certain felonies. We collect their DNA. Now their DNA is on file. They have criminal histories, criminal records. When they get arrested, we track their phone calls. So the next time they get arrested, that phone call they made while they were in jail, now we know who it is and where they live. And where do you think they're probably going to go the next time they're arrested? All of these things. If they're gangbangers, we track who the gang they're with. If they have tattoos, scars, we take pictures of those things. That is how local law enforcement protects you. But it's not happening with these people that aren't supposed to be here. Why not? Why not, I ask? Are they not being tracked? You know, when we were on the NYPD, and Rikers Island had the best tattoo database of anyone in the city. And we would frequently make identifications on criminals through the Rikers Island tattoo database. Simple thing. But when you have a bad criminal out there and you don't have him ID'd, it's very, very frustrating. Mike.
Billy. Corrections gang intelligence units that track gang members and figure out the hierarchy of the gangs through their contacts in jail or in a state prison. they're fantastic because they are a total font of information that you're not going to get on the street where people may be too scared to talk to officers. So therefore, that is huge. And the good thing too, and I hate to say use the word good, but the one benefit of the portability of phones is that, you know, people forget they have them. And these are there are like little GPS systems. So therefore, even the illegal aliens, many of them have phones. And so therefore, if you do are able to figure out what cell phone the person may have, if you're fortunate enough, again, you know, but you may be able to do that. But we don't have a policy. We didn't have a policy back in January of 2021 when the borders were open, and that was it. And therefore, we're trying to catch up, and we're not even trying to catch up yet. But we put ourselves. This is a problem that our nation made for itself, and our law enforcement on the border, they're very frustrated because they're not allowed to do their job. You're talking about the Border Patrol officers, and you're turning them into clerks. Okay, everybody, come over here. Here's a ticket. See you in 7 years. You too. Okay, we got you. Boom, 7 years. You know, it's horrific. And, you know, they're not sending their brightest, their most brilliant PhDs and doctors and engineers and physicists and, you know, things like that. No, what we're getting is like the Mariel boat lift. You know, you get from Cuba back in the early 80s, you're going to get a lot of people dumped out of prisons and the undesirables, and they're coming here. And this is what we got. We did this to ourselves. Very, very shocking.
Absolutely. Kenzie Cush, respect, love from the UK, Great Britain. You guys are having the same issues as us, invaded with unknown men. Yeah, and it's a political policy that is really neither side in our country. We have basically a two-party system. Neither side has fixed this. So there's enough blame to go around to point fingers at both parties because no one has done a thing about this. And guess who suffers for this? Yes, the American citizenry, the taxpayer who's paying taxes to take and a lot of these people aren't even allowed to work. So how are you going to come here? If you're not allowed to work, how are you going to support yourself? Right. You think that there's a never-ending supply of money, of hotel rooms, of, you know, the buck stops here type thing? You know, there's no more money. And they got to figure this out. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed, go on to YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, share us with your friends and your family. And if you want to contribute to us, we have a Patreon with four different levels, and we also have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, five different levels. And as you see, someone in our chat just awarded five Police Off the Cuff memberships to a lucky five people who are now members of the Police Off the Cuff family. Let me get to this first and go back to this for a second.
More about what is coming. Want to welcome them in now. Retired criminal defense attorney Kirk Nurmi is with us, and retired police lieutenant Mike Gold. Great to see you both this morning. Let's start with the trackdown. I couldn't have been more impressed with what police did here. Lieutenant Gold, talk to us here. Your thoughts, please.
Sure. Good morning, Julie. Yeah, so obviously a great day for law enforcement. We need all these wins we can get when we have dedicated people really committed to this case. I find it, you used the right words, scumbag, dirtbag. All of these things are appropriate for the alleged killer. You know, here's the funny thing. I just came back from Bogota last weekend. I flew into Bogota and flew back to Orlando. I was online for about an hour and a half. I was interrogated, basically, and I understand Border Patrol. This is what they do. Where was I? What hotel did I stay at? Where's my passport? Who are you visiting? How much money you got? And as I'm standing on this line for 45 minutes, it kind of dawned on me that there is no line at the Mexican border. And it was really a light bulb went off for me because I was, you know, you're getting interrogated by a border. If you get, what did you bring? What do you have in your bag? Did you purchase anything? So that was my moment, realizing what's happening in our country today.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you sharing that personal story, Lieutenant, because, I mean, law enforcement said this guy's MO is violence. That's what they said. That's what this guy is all about. He was about that in his native country and then didn't come to America to have a better life. They say he didn't come here to try to do good. No, they say he came here to try to commit more crimes. Picked up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They tracked him down. He was at a bar apparently on Friday night when they grabbed him up. It was beautiful. Let's listen to a clip from the press conference now.
This killer could have been laying his head in any community in the country or even in the world. And indeed, that was completely accurate. Over the past 2 weeks, investigators continued their diligent investigation and tracked our suspect all the way from Prince George's County to Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And they picked him up apparently at a local bar there. And so it makes you wonder, what was he up to in Tulsa? Will there be any more alleged crimes announced here? Kirk Nurmi, tapping into your legal expertise here, would you tell us how you expect this picture to look with this guy legally? We know that Maryland is the next stop. What are your thoughts? Will he be sent back to California after that? Do you think he's just going to be deported back to El Salvador after he gets to Maryland?
Yeah, no, I don't think deportation, you know, right away is probably what's going to happen. My experience in Arizona would be that they are going to be tried for any and all crimes that they can be linked to in the United States. So it's not this kind of idea that somebody just gets deported back. That's not generally the way it works. And of course, it shouldn't work that way, because really what his legal status is and what have you probably doesn't matter much to the Marin family, because they've still lost their loved one and they still deserve justice in that regard. So I think that's the first case we're going to see. And given that we have this DNA and given this man's propensity for violent activity, I suspect that that is going to be looked at, put into databases, and see if this man has been guilty of committing any more crimes in the United States.
Kirk, thank you for all of that. You mentioned Rachel's family, and you're right. I mean, they have been through a living nightmare. Nothing can bring their loved one back. And Rachel's mom had a couple big moments at the press conference. I touched on one in my opening statement where she called for that round of applause for law enforcement. And then there was another moment where she talked about how she was in a headspace where everything was looking hopeless. Just hopeless, no answers, radio silence. And she told everyone what the detective said to her, and it really stuck. Let's watch.
At one point, when things seemed like really bleak and hopeless, the lead detective said to me, he said, patience will win in the end. And that's what they've been doing. They've been diligently working very hard, and they've been patiently working through all the leads. And it's because of that that we have an arrest today.
Lieutenant Mike, how many times in your career have you seen that happen?
Yeah, so patience is a virtue, but of course that's easier said than done when you're a family member as a victim of a crime. And then of course we see cases go cold for several years. So it's, look, this wasn't this guy's first rodeo. This wasn't just a spontaneous, this wasn't a robbery. It seems to me he was stalking this person maybe for several days on this walking path. He's a predator, and this will not be his first crime. As Kirk said, once this DNA is revealed, then they can start looking at the DNA of other victims wherever this character has been floating around. And I think there'll be several more cases closed due to the hard work of these investigators.
Mm-hmm. Excellent points from you both. We'll leave it there for.
So, you know, one of the things, Mike, that I think is worth mentioning also is we see great mountains moved with law enforcement when law enforcement partners up with all other agencies of law enforcement. This case, right from the beginning, screams that three-letter word. It's not even a word. The three letters FBI. Because It's undoubtedly going to lead to outside this country. It's undoubtedly going to need the resources of the federal government, i.e. money and personnel. And it's going to need the technology of the federal government. And right from the very start, they enlisted the help of the FBI. And they enlisted what other law enforcement partnerships they needed And that is the only way they would have solved this case, Mike.
Yeah, Billy, the FBI has so much, such a bigger budget. They have a lot more personnel, investigators than like the county in Maryland has. So therefore, they've got all of the technical skills that the Maryland detectives can't access. They've got the ability to travel across the country because they're federal agents, so they go wherever they want to go. They can go internationally. And so figuring out that this person was from El Salvador was huge, because then they could, through the State Department, they could get clearance to travel down there. It's fantastic. For all of the good local police officers in small towns and small cities and things like that, as good as they can possibly be, there's always somebody who's got a bigger budget with a lot more expertise in certain things, and that's the FBI. And that's why they're absolutely necessary, because they have the ability to do so much technical advances and do much more work than you can do on your own. And so we saw that also in the Koberger case. They were brought in within like 24 hours, and they helped lead this investigation to a successful conclusion. And so therefore, you got to have that cooperation. We always tease each other. There's that old rivalry going on with the FBI. But you know what? They can do some amazing things that local cops can't do.
Absolutely. And you know something also, Mike, when a few years ago we had that thing, the defund the police movement. And one of the first things that goes when they defund the police or they cut police budgets is training. Yeah. And cases like this, you can directly correlate the solvability to well-trained police officers, because some police officers can disregard evidence or not sure is this evidence or not take evidence that contains DNA. In this case, linking that case from Los Angeles to this case in Maryland was absolutely huge. And to do things like that, you need training. You need good officers. You need officers that know how to recognize what is evidence, where to find evidence. I know it sounds simplistic to people that aren't in law enforcement, but not all, every single law enforcement is as good as the next guy. You have your stars, and then you have some, dull stars. not so bright, shining stars, I'll put it that way. So the training is so, so important.
It's expensive and it's time consuming, and it takes people away from working out on the street. But the greater training that you have, and the more officers that you have, better trained, the better the police force. The defund the police movement, it was sold to the American public as a bill of goods to improve policing. But, you need to have a serious corpus of officers on the street who are well-trained, and the idea that you're going to cut one-eighth of the New York City police budget. It's fanciful idea from like decarceration. It sounds nice. It's something that you could write about in a PhD program. It sounds great. But what are the practical effects of those decisions? And the practical effect is that you have lesser trained officers. You don't have the experienced officers. Look at the NYPD, just as an example. Thousands and thousands of officers are leaving, and the brain drain is going to other places. And that is a disservice to the people, the taxpayers, and the law-abiding people of all colors, all races, all creeds, all income levels in New York City. You're condemning them to a less than stellar police department, and that is sad, because we should, as the NYPD, as a member of the NYPD, you should be proud of the fact that we had the best police department, municipal police department, that we think in the world. Cutting back and chanting things to fund the police. Yeah, you can chant all kinds of things, but be careful what you wish for.
Well, Mike, one of the things, and I'm not going to get political with this, but when you defund the police or have less police, and then you try to claim that crime is down, I think they're just not taking reports. And that's sure. That is how crime they can manipulate the numbers so it appears that crime has gone down. Because when you don't have enough officers out there just to do their job, guess what? They're not taking reports for crime.
Right.
And certain crimes that used to be serious, nah. Now, what is a grand larceny now? It used to be over $1,000. I don't even think they prosecute those. So do you think that encumbers police from taking reports? If they're not going to prosecute it, why should I take a report? And you can bet that they're doing that from top down. And, of course, the top will swear on a stack of Bibles that that's not what's occurring. But I guarantee, because we're hearing heinous, ridiculous crimes that we didn't hear about 10, 15 years ago. They're back. They're coming back. These horrific crimes of people riding around on mopeds and snatching the purses of old ladies and dragging them across the street. That stopped dead 10 years ago, 15 years. It's back. It's back, right? Gunpoint robberies just last week. An NYPD police officer off duty from the 3-2 precinct has two mutts come up to him, both armed with guns. They carjack him. The word carjack was taken out of the law enforcement vernacular for a bunch of years. Guess what? It's back. So don't tell me that crime is down. We're seeing crimes that were not happening when crime was down. Taking reports is down, not crime.
Billy, yeah, juggling the numbers is something I've seen, and I saw that back in the 80s and the 90s. Absolutely. Every police chief wants lower crime numbers, so there's no incentive to have your police officers take a lot of crime reports, 61s we call them. You know, you have crime, you have 61s, you know, complaint reports. No, your career is better when the crime numbers are going down. And look, if the politicians appear weak, if they appear weak to the general public, the perpetrators are out there. They're hunters. They hunt people. That's what they do. They're criminals. And they smell fear. And they know that there's not going to be any enforcement. The day you tell the public you're not going to arrest people for grand larceny, prosecute people for grand larceny, guess what? You have now made every single man, woman, and child in every store, every establishment a target now, because it's a free reign on they're the target now. Yeah. And so therefore these people are going to do what they're going to do. They might only be, you know, 3% of the population, but they probably account for like 90% of the crime that's committed. So they smell fear. They know what you're going to do. They're not stupid, and they're going to push it as far as they can. And the American public ends up being victimized unnecessarily. Crimes that, as you say, didn't occur. We didn't have these kind of carjackings in New York. New York was a very safe place a decade ago. You know,
oh, Mike, you know, I almost forgot. Last week, two cops in Queens were shot by an illegal.
That's right.
And one, his life was saved by his bulletproof vest. And I believe the other one got hit in the foot. But, you know, if the guy didn't have his vest on, he very well could be attending a police funeral. So tell me about crime being down, you know? Tell me about it.
We had a person shot in Times Square. Now, remember, Times Square is a gun-free zone.
Yeah,
and we had somebody shot there. I guess the perp didn't know it was a gun-free zone. I guess
he brought his gun, and he had like a 30-round clip for his gun, too.
Right. So
he doesn't know about the clip size either. He doesn't know that that's banned, too. You know?
He didn't get that memo. But that's the audacity of these people. They don't care. They're hunters. They don't care.
Absolutely. Liz Gee, welcome to the Police Off the Cuff YouTube member, and welcome to the family. Welcome aboard. I think you'll find this podcast to be quite interesting. Let me play a little bit of this, Mike. And
joined now by Rachel Morin's brother, Michael Morin, and the family's attorney, Randolph Rice. Michael, what's your reaction to the arrest? Do you feel like you have the closure you need, or that guilty verdict? How are you feeling?
I mean, initially when I heard the news, I was elated. You know, I was just so thankful. It was an answer to, you know, months of prayers. Just very grateful that he's caught right now. And I know it's just the next stage of this process, and it's going to be a long road going forward. But right now I'm just, you know, very grateful, you know, answer to prayer.
Michael, the suspect is being extradited to Harford County, Maryland now. Will he be tried for Rachel's murder? Do you know?
Yeah, I spoke with investigators, and I believe, you know, that's my understanding, is that he's going to be tried for murder and rape of my sister before any of the other charges.
I think it's easy when we listen to the news to just think that these stories are far away, or just to think of them as stories, but you're a real person. Rachel was a real person. She left behind a family. How are all of you doing today?
I mean, I think we're all grieving a little different, you know, but it's the hardest for the five children. So family spending a lot of time with them and, you know, just being there for them.
I want you to know personally, I mean, I just send all my thoughts and all my prayers to you and your entire family. I have not experienced murder, but I did experience having my family ripped away from you. And I know how devastating that can be, and wondering if you'll ever see them again. So please know that I will continue to keep you and all of your family in my thoughts. Randolph, 10 months after Rachel's murder, are you surprised it's taken so long to identify the suspect?
Early on, we thought that it did take a little bit longer than expected. When you have a DNA hit and you have a doorbell camera and then ultimately the sketch, you would think in most cases it's a slam dunk. But the problem was they didn't have a name to link to that DNA profile. But I got to tell you, the detective in the Harford County Sheriff's Department, the FBI, they kept with the facts, they kept with the case, and they pushed forward. And really, they're the ones to thank for this capture of this suspect, because they did the hard work. They were patient, and they ended on a high note with catching this individual in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Do you feel like testing the DNA should have been maybe like the first thing they did, and using the genealogy?
Well, they did that. They did obtain that DNA.
She is so clueless about how they do this. Just absolutely clueless. But she means well, so we'll let her get away with it.
Result, but the genealogy does take time, and that was something that they were saying along the way, that look, it just takes time to work through the genealogy. It's not an overnight process like a DNA test to match. So we understand, obviously, 10 months just seems like forever, and I'm sure Michael can say that it's been an agonizing 10 months, but there's a little bit of hope, obviously, that he's been captured. He'll be brought back to Maryland within the next week or two. He'll be go before the case will go before a grand jury, where he will no doubt be indicted. He'll be held without bail, and ultimately have to make the decision as to take a plea in this case or go to trial. That's something that we'll find out in the future.
Do you know, or have you heard, if anyone was helping him hide during this whole 10-month search for him?
The sheriff's department has indicated that there was a connection through some gangs. There are some known gangs in America from that region. That was one of the ways he was able to travel around the country, is a belief that the sheriff's department does have. So I think all that will come out as they do more investigation. And this is important that we're still talking about this case, because there are still facts they're collecting. There's still evidence they're collecting. They want to put together a profile and a picture as to how this man came from El Salvador and made it to Maryland.
Do you think there are more victims out there?
I believe there are, and here's why. We've got a time frame or difference between March of 2023 and Rachel's death in August of 23, and then August up until the date he was captured this past Friday. A man who kills in El Salvador, attacks in Los Angeles, kills in Maryland. There has to be more victims out there. We're hoping those victims come forward.
Thank you for watching.
So that was, you know, it's the same old story, that they have to stop this at the border. Not, you can't let career criminals, dangerous predators, get into this country and then make it law enforcement's problem, and make it the problem of the citizenry, because they're not being protected. Mike, I want to thank you so much. So this is the second show we did today. We did an earlier show at 3. I want to thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
I think, you know, this case has been covered. It's not, it's a case that's going to keep happening across this country over and over again. And we can't solve the problems. It has to be done at a much higher level. There has to be legislation. And it hasn't been done for years, and the system has been broken for years. Mike, your final thoughts?
I'm grateful for the DNA technology, how far it is advanced, and thankful that Harford County, Maryland Department worked well with the FBI, and everybody seemed to go above and beyond in this case. And luckily, it took 9 months, but that isn't slow in this kind of case with all the technology that they had to employ to get this guy. So that was fantastic. So everybody keep the faith, and don't join any sort of defund the police movements, because that's just nonsense. And you need to have a strong, vibrant law enforcement out there to protect you from what we see coming across our borders.
100%. And folks, finally, I just want everyone to remember this woman, Rachel Morin, a mother of five. A life was taken. And we have to try to do something about this never happening again in the future. And I can't obviously say that it could never happen again. But you see the face of evil to the left and in the middle, and the face of a mother all the way to the right. And as I said, we pray for her and for her family that they can recover from this horrific tragedy. Folks, thanks for tuning in tonight. This is Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. On behalf of myself and Professor Mike Geary, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Okay. One episode, just ain't enough.